WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Archive Edition, Pete Townshend tells us why he smashed so many guitars. Townshend, who co-founded The Who, has a new Best Of CD and a new Tommy CD-ROM. The NBA playoffs are underway. We'll hear from one of the greatest players in basketball history, Julius Erving. In his 16 years in the pros, Dr. J racked up more than 30,000 points and moved the game of basketball into the air. And film critic Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews The Truth About Cats and Dogs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres have announced a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah guerrillas to take effect early tomorrow morning local time. The agreement ends over 2 weeks of shelling in southern Lebanon and northern Israel that has left over 150 people dead. Christopher emphasized that the pact is only the first step in putting an end to the strife in southern Lebanon.
I want to make it clear that these understandings are not a substitute for a complete and permanent solution. They are not a substitute for a peace agreement between Israel and Lebanon. That is why the United States believes that the resolution of this crisis should be the basis for returning to negotiations seeking a comprehensive peace.
The truce is the culmination of a week of shuttle diplomacy by Christopher. Prime Minister Peres said the agreement imposes no limitations on the Israeli army, which operates in a self-imposed security zone in southern Lebanon. The White House says President Clinton will sign a spending bill for the remainder of fiscal 1996 today, and the president says he still wants to resume talks on balancing the budget over the next 7 years. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton hailed the passage of the $160 billion budget for this fiscal year as a triumph of progress over partisanship. The budget is 7 months late and came only after a bitter partisan standoff that included two partial government shutdowns. Now the president says he wants to revive the failed negotiations over a larger 7-year balanced budget plan.
I want to meet with members of Congress. I'll do it in a large group or a small one, or one-on-one. But I want to finish the job. We have an opportunity. We can't let it slip from our grasp. We have seen now with this year's budget and the anti-terrorism bill that we can do things together.
But Republicans say they aren't sure the president means what he says. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says he and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole will develop a yardstick to measure the sincerity of any new White House proposals. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A 6-year-old boy in Oakland, California, has been charged with attempted murder and burglary in the beating of an infant during the theft of a tricycle from the baby's home. The 8-year-old twins who allegedly joined the younger boy in the Monday night break-in have been charged with burglary. The three boys are in juvenile detention pending a custody hearing today. The infant is in critical condition. The AFL-CIO says America's 25-year-old worker health and safety program is a big success. The labor organization says the Occupational Safety and Health Act has helped reduce fatalities in the workplace by almost 75%. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6.5 points. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite is up 1.5 points. This is NPR. Thousands of people gathered at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine this morning for a candlelight vigil to mark the 10th anniversary of the worst nuclear disaster ever. The explosion in one of the reactors at Chernobyl released 200 times as much radiation as the two atomic bombs dropped on Japan combined. The accident released a radioactive cloud that affected millions of people. A hardline Islamic group in Algeria is threatening to kill 7 monks unless the French government agrees to exchange them for Algerians imprisoned in France. The monks were captured last month. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The hardline armed Islamic group said in a statement it would release the 7 monks if France freed a list of Algerians who were in jail. The statement said if the government refuses, it will kill the 7 men. They were kidnapped from an isolated monastery in Algeria last month by gunmen. This is the first claim of responsibility for the kidnapping. The monks have been in Algeria for decades, and the oldest one is 82. The French Foreign Ministry said it had not been able to verify if the statement is genuine. It was printed in an Arab-language newspaper in London and reportedly sent to French President Jacques Chirac. The French spokesman demanded that the group release the 7 monks unharmed. He didn't comment on the possibility of exchanging Algerians for the 7 Frenchmen. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Florida has become the first state in the union to ban the sale of herbal products that contain the stimulant ephedrine, which mimics the effects of the illegal drug ecstasy. The state's agriculture commissioner took the action after a spring break visitor to Florida died of an ephedrine overdose last month. The ban exempts diet pills and sinus medications that contain ephedrine. Former Olympic gymnastics star Nadia Comaneci married her longtime American fiancé, gymnast Bart Conner, today in a civil ceremony at the Army Club in Bucharest. About 2,000 fans watched on a giant TV screen outside the club. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pete Townsend, The Who's co-founder, guitarist, and main songwriter, has a new best-of collection of his solo work. On this archive edition, we have a 1993 interview with him. The Who was founded in 1964 in London and soon became a voice of teenage rebellion with anthems like Townsend's song My Generation. This song has his most famous line, "Hope I die before I get old."
Put us to down.
Talking about my generation,
just because we get around.
Talking about my generation,
things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation,
I hope I die before I get old.
Townsend's rebellious energy was expressed not only in his songs, but in his power chords and in the way he'd smash his guitar at the end of his concerts. Even people who don't know much about The Who are aware of their rock opera Tommy, about the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who became a pinball wizard. The 1969 album was adapted into a Ken Russell film, more recently a Broadway hit, and now there's a Tommy CD-ROM. Townsend told me that in 1991, before he decided to take Tommy to Broadway, he broke his wrist in a bicycle accident, which left him temporarily unable to play.
The wrist injury was a life-changing thing for me. It changed a whole lot of things. And because it was so, in the short term, immediately after the accident, it was so devastating. I couldn't write, I couldn't type, I certainly couldn't play any musical instrument, and it was a very, very complicated fracture, and I had no idea whether physiotherapy was going to get what kind of movement I was going to get back. And all the signs were that it was going to be a long, drawn-out process of maybe 5 years with maybe three or four operations. So I was kind of looking at, you know, and I suppose in a way I was already in semi-retirement. I had a career as a solo artist, but, you know, I didn't, you know, it's not something that takes up an immense amount of time. I just had time to stop and look at what was happening in my life and who I was and who I wanted to be and you know, how much I really cared about not being able to play and how much I really cared about not being able to write and that kind of thing.
So how much has your wrist healed?
It seems to be okay. But I play slightly differently now, I think.
How so?
Because the actual flexibility of the wrist is reduced. Mm-hmm. I can't do those kind of flourishing, very, very fast flamenco-y things holding a plectrum, which is part of the kind of, not just the distinction of the way that I play, but also a vanity, you know, personal vanity. Nobody else that I know was ever able to do that, and now I can't do it either. So
when you hurt your arm and you say you asked yourself how much you cared about not being able to play, how much did you care?
I didn't care very much. I think I thought I was going to miss being able to sit around with a guitar and entertain myself. But I immediately started to learn to write longhand with my left hand. And by the time my right hand started to work, I was almost completely left-handed. Take something away from somebody and it makes you revalue everything else that you've got. And I think that's what I did. So no, I'm not trying to be callous or hard or indifferent to my talent. But that was the space I was in. I was kind of in a space where I wasn't really worrying so much about what I'd lost, but I was very interested in what I'd gained. And I had a very clear list of things to do, 100 things to do, you know, while you can't play the guitar. And one of the things at the very, very bottom of the list, and I managed to actually get through this list in about a week. One of the things at the bottom of the list was go and see Mum, my mother, and ask her about the lost years.
The lost years?
The lost years.
The years when you were with your grandparents?
Yeah.
Well, it was your parents were on the road, I think. Your father was a musician.
Yeah.
And well, you spent, when you were about 5 to 7, you were with your grandparents.
That's right. Not with my grandparents. I was with my grandmother, who was a single woman. She actually deserted my mother when she was married.
Why was it so important to you to feel? What did you need to know about that?
Well,
time?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember anything, and I couldn't remember very much about those years. All I could remember was really quite unpleasant things, and I wanted to know. So I went to see my mother, and I said, "Listen, don't give me any details. Don't give me any stuff. Don't give me any emotion. Just give me facts. I want to know where I was on, you know, June the 1st, where I was on June the 2nd, and because I said, you know, let me." Digest that, and then I'll come back later and ask you about the emotional stuff, the personal stuff, and the reasons. And whenever she did, I ran a tape machine, and whenever she digressed, I got her back on track and said, "No, listen, just stick to the facts and help me, because you know." And she's been preparing material about her own life. She's trying to write a book about her own life, and so a lot of the stuff was fairly fresh in her mind, but.
So did this, were there revelations for you in what she told you?
Yeah. I mean, shocking revelations.
Like what? I don't know if you'd care to share them or not.
I can't really share them.
That's fine.
But what I realized was is that some of the memories that I did have of my childhood, that stopped, you know, where you know, you kind of go into a dark tunnel and you can't see what's at the other end of a memory. I'd actually remembered them in my work, that my writing was the memory that still functioned. You know, I've even been in therapy and, you know, confronted or come to that point where I've actually tried to, you know, remember that stuff. And my therapist once said to me, I'm not in therapy anymore, I did it for 3 years, write it down, you know, write it down. Write down what happened. And when you come to the point that you can't remember, just keep writing. And when I sat down to start writing, I started to get this incredible feeling of dread. And it was so enormous that I just broke down, and I realized that if I continued to try to remember, I would actually have a kind of nervous breakdown, and decided not to go on. You know, and I don't think, and what's interesting is just so that people don't think this is the Oprah Winfrey show. what the reason why I can't talk about what happened is that I don't think it's particularly significant. Comparison to the terrible, terrible things that have happened to people that I know and that people that I read about. But its effect on me was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't mean to suggest deep, dark secrets necessarily.
Right.
A curious kind of, you know, definitely a curious byproduct of being the child of not only two very young people who were born in the war, met in the war and married in the Air Force. And you know, my father was very glamorous, wonderful looking, looked like a film star. My mother was a very sexy, well-dressed young girl. And you know, I think, you know, I came along very, very quickly. I think my mother, you know, conceived me like within about a week of their marriage. And there I was, you know, and I think, you know, he was out on the road, still young, having fun. And my mother had been a singer in a band. And I think she just wanted some time to herself. So she hung with me for about 2.5-3 years. And they were such fantastic years. You know, I was out on the road with my mum and dad. And I was with them all the time. And I used to sleep in between them. You know, I was in the way. I was there. I was the star of the show. I was on the stage. I can remember show business. And then it just goes black.
Well, how did show business look to you when you were young and your parents were on the road? Was that the kind of life you thought you might want for yourself sometime?
Oh, there was no question. That was what I was going to do.
That's what you wanted.
Yeah, no, it wasn't what I wanted. It's what I had. It was where I was. It's like, you know, this is Liza Minnelli and Lorna Luft. You know, except that for me, it was both mum and dad there all the time, and this extended family. It's a big dance orchestra. You know, with like 26 members.
But your father played clarinet.
Clarinet and saxophone, yeah.
And your mother sang?
Yeah, yeah.
No, before rock, and before you seriously took up guitar, you liked trad jazz, and I think you even played banjo before you got serious about the guitar. What did you prefer about jazz during the period that you were into that and didn't listen to that much rock?
Oh, this is a neat conjunction. It was the fact that it connected more with my father. And the kind of music that he played. The band used to play a Dixieland set in the show, which was very popular when I was a teenager. This is my father's band.
Mm-hmm.
It was a concession to the young people, you know, the crazy young people who like that jazz stuff, because most of it was ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So this was a sort of 20-minute set, and my father played lead clarinet, and I used to love that because this seemed to me to be, you know, where, this was pre my discovery of rock and roll. And had I been exposed, you know, to, I don't know, John Lee Hooker or Hank Williams or any of those kind of early, or even Pete Seeger or any of those people that were kind of defining how the song was going to become a rock song, and, you know, how the song of those three different distinct forms of popular music would come together as the rock song 10 years later. If I'd have heard that music, I don't know whether I would have responded to it at all. I had no context for it. So I think, you know, the trad jazz thing was just, you know, it was something that grew out of my need to do something that connected with my dad, who I worshipped.
Pete Townsend is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Pete Townsend. You went to art school, though. Did you have artistic aspirations? In the visual arts?
Well, I'm actually quite good at painting and and my visual eye is quite good. You know, I designed all the Who's early clothes, and you know, and posters and things like that, logos, and I'm quite good in that area. But mm-hmm. actually, before that, before I actually played the guitar, you know, from the ages of about from 8 upwards to about 12, I wanted to be a journalist, and I think that actually informed my. The way that I think probably more than being an artist. What going to art school did for me was not finish me off as an artist, because the course that I went to turned out to be a really crazy course. It actually turned me into a radical. It's the same course that David Bowie did. It's the same course that Brian Eno did. A deconstructionist kind of English Bauhaus course called the basic course, produced by a bunch of English artists who wanted to radicalize art school teaching.
Now, let me ask you about the beginnings of your music. Having come to rock and roll after being interested in jazz, after having played guitar, after having worshipped your father who played clarinet, when you started playing rock and roll, you really cranked up the volume and started using feedback and distortion, getting really far away from the sounds you were first interested in. Can you tell me why you became so interested in volume and distortion?
Well, there are a couple of different things. I mean, there's a sort of a sociologist in me on this subject, and I think that and if I can actually talk about Jim Marshall as an example here, I won't talk about me. Let me talk about Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall's father was a boxer. Jim Marshall is the man who invented the Marshall amplifier, you know, the big stack that the Who used, that mm-hmm. Eric Clapton used, that Jimi Hendrix adopted when he came to the UK, that big wall of sound thing. And Jim had a music shop. And one day I went in, and we'd been playing at pubs, and I said, I've got these two American amplifiers, Jim. I've got a Fender Pro Amp and a Fender Bassman Amp. And I said, they're great amplifiers. They sound great. And I was already using a certain amount of feedback. And I said, but the trouble is that I can hear the audience. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can hear them. You know, I mean, if I'm playing and somebody's in the front row and they say, this is junk, I can hear what they're saying. I don't want to hear them, okay? And I said, so I need something bigger and louder. And his eyes lit up. And I said, can you do this for me? And he said, and he got his engineer out and he said, do you think you can do this? And the guy said, yeah, I think I can do it. You know, I can do it. I could think I can do it. And I realized at that moment that what was actually happening was that I was demanding a more powerful machine gun. And Jim Marshall was going to build it for me. And then we were going to go out and blow people away all around the world. And the generation we were going to blow away was the generation immediately preceding us, the ones who had the gall to tell us that we were wimps because we had long hair, wimps because we didn't have wars to fight in, wimps because we couldn't prove ourselves in military service because we didn't have it, you know, it was not necessary anymore. We were post-atomic bomb people, that we were wimps, 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 and that the only reason that we even had electric guitars and rock and roll was because they'd paved the way for peace and given everything up, which is, of course, absolutely true they had. You know, and Remembrance Day is a day that I take very seriously. I think that anger was something that really crossed over generations. It wasn't just from rock and roll. It just wasn't from me and my need to smash guitars. It was right over the whole industry, right through the whole of show business and rock and roll and the media and everybody. Everybody of that generation wanted it to be bigger, louder, and wanted it to be as big as the atomic bomb had been.
Now, how do you connect this to smashing guitars?
I think the connection isn't actually, you would call it in CD-ROM talk, you would call it a hyperlink. I don't think it's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. I think it's a byproduct of stage performance. I think, you know, you know, the first guitar that I broke in front of my grandmother, when I was 14.
Were you impressing her, or was this a mistake?
No. It was another take on the Jim Marshall story. She bought me my first guitar, which was a piece of trash. Uh-huh. And I was very upset because my father had recommended the guitar because I couldn't play the clarinet, and I wanted him to buy the guitar. So I was angry that she bought me this piece of trash. And And it was very, very hard to play. And my dad said, well, you know, she has bought it for you. She is your grandmother. Try and learn to play something on it. And if you can, then I'll buy you a new one. And this went on and on and on and on. And one day I'm clunking away at this horrible kind of guitar, which was really fit only to be hung on the wall at a, you know, at an Italian restaurant next to the Chianti bottles. And I think that's where it probably came from. And she came in and she said, this is a bloody awful row, you know, why don't you play some proper music? And I said, listen, Nan, it's, you know, it's we know what we're doing, you know, leave us alone. And I was with John Entwistle, who was, you know, we were little kids, really. And she said, no, turn it off, it's a bloody horrible row. So, and she said, if you don't turn it off, I'll smash it. So I said, no, you won't smash it. And I got the guitar, and I smashed it over the amplifier. I broke an amplifier at the same time too, a little kind of tiny amplifier, and she went completely white and walked out of the room. And John said, "You've done it now," and I said, "I might have." I said, "But John, I feel great." And of course, I was able then to, you know, to go and look for a decent guitar and rob and steal to get it, which is what I did. And I found myself a decent instrument. And from there on, I never looked back, really.
Yeah, but once you had a good instrument, why did you smash that on stage?
Guitars are very good for me to express myself by smashing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good for me to express myself by playing them. They're very good for express myself by pouring lighter fluid over them and warming my hands. You know, it depends what I'm doing. You know.
But let me ask you, how did the feeling you had the first time you smashed a guitar on stage compare to the feeling you had like the 100th time or the 200th time you'd done it? Did it still feel as good? Did it feel good in a different way?
I don't think it's ever felt good at all. I don't think it's something that I expected to feel good.
I mean, good in the sense of a release.
I don't think it's ever felt good as a sense of a release. I don't, you know, I'm afraid it's too, it's always been too, you know, I've always used the instrument that I happen to be playing at the time, and I mean, as I see it splinter, I'm thinking, oh my God, $1,000. But you know, I've actually been enough of an artist and believed in the act enough to do it again and again and again.
Well, what does the act mean to you?
It means a number of things. I think It's a statement mainly of artistic independence. I mean, it's also an act of, it's in the same tone as, you know, as you know, we want our amplifiers to be loud so that we can't hear the response. It's like saying, okay, the show is over now. I am finished. And in a sense, that all music is over now. Everything to do with this particular event is over now. It's finished. You know, the interaction between me, you, and this guitar is over now. It's a big, dramatic action. And the reason that it has to, in a way, be theatrically violent, because I think that's as far as it gets. It's, you know, we used to smash our equipment up and then go back and drink, you know, cups of lemon tea. Like, I think that the reason that it needs to be theatrically violent is in a way that it is because the observation that the thing that we're trying, you know, get out of the you know to the response that we want from the audience is one of absolute reflection at that moment on everything that's happened up to that point. You know, to stun them, to actually stop them.
Well, I really wish we had more time to talk, but we have to wrap up. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
For being with us.
Pete Townsend recorded in 1993. He has a new best of CD of his solo work, and there's a new Tommy CD-ROM. Next week, Pete Townsend will perform in New York at the Supper Club. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Townsend's new best of CD, this is Misunderstood.
Just wanna be misunderstood. Wanna be feared in my neighborhood. Just wanna be a moody man. Say things that nobody can understand. I wanna be obscure and oblique, inscrutable and vague, so hard to pin down. I wanna leave open mouths when I speak, want people to cry when I put them down. I wanna be either old or young, don't like where I've ended up or where I've begun. I always feel I must get things in the can, I just can't handle it the way I am. Why am I so straight and simple? People see through me like I'm made of glass. Why can't I deepen with graying temples? Am I growing out of my class?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The NBA playoffs are underway. Coming up on this archive edition, an interview with one of basketball's greatest players, Julius Erving. The former Philadelphia 76er retired from the game in 1987. Also, Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews the new film, The Truth About Cats and Dogs. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The NBA playoffs are underway. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Julius Erving. With his jumps and slam dunks, he moved the sport of basketball into the air. He was such a graceful player that Temple University gave him an honorary degree in dance. Dr. J was not only beautiful to watch, he was the consummate role model. When he retired in 1987, sports writer Frank DeFord wrote, "Of all the people who have played games in the 20th century, perhaps two or three have been nicer human beings than Julius Erving." Erving started his pro career with the American Basketball Association, where he was widely considered the greatest player in the league. When the ABA folded in 1976, Erving joined the Philadelphia 76ers, where he played until he retired in 1987. After he retired, Erving became a businessman. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1993. I spoke with him in 1994 and asked how he developed his acrobatic style in the air.
I think that just evolved. I was always an aggressive player, particularly in high school. As a matter of fact, many of my friends and my teammates used to say that I was wild because I would really attack the basket, and I would attack it for rebounds. I would attack it in trying to protect the basket. If a player came to the basket, I would attack him. And I used to foul a lot, but you know, the level of play determines certain things. And you know, when you're young and you're playing at the elementary level, what is a foul there wouldn't necessarily be a foul on the next level or a higher level. And when I went to the basket, if I got hacked by somebody, I mean, I would never call fouls. I would always call guys crybabies who, you know, who would whine and complain about getting hit. And I said, look, you know, when you go play against the big boys, you're going to get hit like that, and you're not going to, you know, they're not going to make the call. So don't make it here. But, you know, that was just my opinion. And as it turned out, you know, my opinion proved to be the truth, because it was very beneficial that, you know, I could play through physical contact and, you know, be a high scoring player and not a crybaby, because I think, you know, a lot of crybabies, officials look upon crybabies as floppers, guys who are faking it many of the time, and they don't reward them with free throws.
Now, what about learning how to jump? I mean, how to jump real high. Is that something, a gift you naturally had? Is that something you worked at?
Combination of the two. I think I had some innate ability, and once again, my physical build, the physical attributes that I was blessed with by my creator, enabled me to be a pretty good leaper, but it was something that I also worked hard on. I did isometric drills,
mm-hmm.
I did different jumping drills, and after learning about the different jumping drills that were available to be done, I always worked to try and perfect the drill, figuring that's where you're going to get the maximum development for your muscles, and you're going to get the maximum in terms of your timing. So much of jumping and jumping high and looking good and being in control when you leave the ground has to do with, first of all, a lack of a fear of landing and landing improperly and getting hurt, and then the timing, jumping at the right time. So that you get the maximum out of the jump, and you're not, you know, wasting energy. One of the things, I can tell you a little story if you want to listen to it. When I was a kid, probably 8 or 9 years old, I lived in a housing project in Hempstead, New York, out on Long Island, and we lived on the third floor of the apartment building. And when my mom used to send me on errands, or it was to go to the store and, you know, pick up a loaf of bread or butter or whatever, I used to always see how fast I could do it. And, you know, so I would time myself. And I figured out that, you know, I'd run out the apartment door and I'd go down, you know, three different flights of steps. And then I'd run to the store, which was only about a block and a half away. And then in coming back, you know, I had to run up three flights of steps. And I tried to figure out a way to get up those steps a little more quickly. So I began getting into the habit of leaping up the steps, and I got to the point where, you know, I could jump up three steps, then four, then five, then six, then seven, and then I could jump up, you know, all seven steps to the landing area. And I remember as a kid just challenging myself to do that, and I didn't realize that that was going to come into play later in life in terms of what I was to become professionally. But it just shows one of the mysterious ways in which things turn out.
Was your style considered flamboyant when you got to the NBA?
I think from a purist view, there were a lot of purists who didn't like my style of play. And it really didn't become acceptable until we won. And it happened actually before the NBA. I had a five-year career in the ABA,
mm-hmm.
which is also a part of the Basketball Encyclopedia's history, a league that existed for 9 years and coexisted with the NBA until it was a merger in 1976 of the four remaining teams in the ABA with the NBA teams. And I think about my second year in the ABA, in which I was playing for the Virginia Squires, a defunct team, as they call them, one of the most pure of the basketball purists, a guy named Adolph Rupp, who was a legendary coach of University of Kentucky, saw me play, and you know, I beat the Kentucky Colonels that night with a last-second shot from the top of the key. And he came into the locker room, and he told me personally, he said, you know, I used to always tell my players never leave their feet unless they knew what they were going to do. And, you know, he had watched me play, and I was one of those players who would leave their feet and then create something while I was in the air. And I didn't know what I was going to do all the time. I just knew I was trying to do something positive, and you didn't know whether it was going to be a shot, a pass, or what have you. And, you know, sometimes those plays end up in turnovers, but, you know, one of my slogans was always dare to be great. So he came in, and he said, you know, I always thought when players did things like that, or if they were flashy, flamboyant, or they did things away from the fundamentals, that, you know, that they were losers, you know, but you're a winner. And, you know, it was really a supreme compliment being paid to a very young player by a guy who had been around, who was coming to understand that change isn't always bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in this sport, particularly in the last 10 years, we've seen tremendous changes. And we've seen it, you know, we've seen the players adapt physically and otherwise, and we've seen the fans adapt. And the modern era game is really a lot different than it was in the early days.
Well, and you're part of the reason why. I mean, you took the game more into the air than it had ever been before. Did you ever feel like your coach wanted you to tone that down, outside of the story that you just told us?
Well, my sophomore year in college, I was at the University of Massachusetts, and Jack Lehman was a basketball coach there, and he's a great friend. And the two kids who were sophomores along with me, both from New Jersey, and this one kid and myself had a little alley-oop play that we had worked on. So we got into a game, and he threw the lob pass over the zone defense, and I caught the ball in the air above the rim, and I just laid it in with a finger roll. And after we scored the basket, our coach called timeout. I mean, he was so upset because it was a non-purist play. It was a glimpse of the future. And, you know, he bawled us out on the sideline. He says, I don't remember ever designing that play, you know, and what are you guys doing? You guys take that back to New York and New Jersey or, you know, or get with the program. And we got with the program, but it was the first time that, you know, had really felt a resistance to, you know, being innovative on the court. And, you know, it was a short-lived experience because I think, you know, after about another week or two, he came around and just realized that, you know, we were down in a couple of games. And we were down in a game, and our plays weren't being worked to perfection. And he looked at the two of us. He says, remember that play you guys ran a few weeks ago? You threw the ball over the defense. You think it could work now? We said, yeah, let's give it a shot. And it became one of our regular plays after that.
Well, I'm wondering if your early years, if you had two different styles of playing, one for playing in the streets and the other for playing on your team in school.
I don't think my style was that different, school versus playground. I got oriented to organized basketball when I was about 9 years old. I think at 8 or 9, when I lived in Hempstead, I was introduced to the Salvation Army through their recreation center. And I was playing out in one of the parks, a park called Camel Park, outside of the housing projects where I lived. And a guy came by one day, a guy named Andy Haggerty, who's no longer with us. And he saw me and a lot of other kids playing outside. And, you know, there was ice on the ground, and it was December. And he said, how'd you kids like to go play basketball inside? And we said, sure. So we got permission from our parents, and he took us to a place which was about 3 miles from where we lived. And it was a nice indoor facility. And the Salvation Army ran it, and they had a gym, and they had a chapel. And that was, to me, that gentleman and that experience was a change agent in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the recreation center. I learned how to play organized basketball. So even when I played in the playground, I always played organized basketball and you know, played with rules and adhered to you know, the things that are important to know about playing basketball. You know, playing with teammates, and you know, on offense you're trying to score, on defense you're trying to stop the other team from scoring. You know, all the other things are pretty much extracurricular. How it evolved into, you know, the flamboyant style that I played, I think there were times when I got on the basketball court by myself and I used to experiment, and I used to just go through a lot of the trial and error process of throwing the ball up on the backboard a lot of different ways and seeing how it would react. It actually was, you know, almost like a geometrical experiment, throwing it up, putting a, you know, top spin on it, bottom spin, left, right. And I don't know why I did those things, but, you know, I did those mostly by myself, and every now and then in a game, I'd be forced in a position where, you know, I'm attacking the basket, someone gets in the way, and, you know, in order to avoid the contact, you twist or turn, and then, or you leap away from them, and then, you know, throw it up, and because of the angle that you're throwing it up from, you have to put a certain type of spin on it.
Boy, it sounds like you almost had a scientific approach to the game.
I would say some parts of my game were very scientific, and I you know, it might have held me back in some regards, because although I put a lot of time into it, you know, I never wanted to be, I guess, locked into the stereotypical view, you know, the young black athlete who can only do, you know, one thing, go out and play basketball. So all the while I was trying to perfect my game as a basketball player, I think I was focusing in realistic of the possibilities that I might not have a professional basketball career. And there were other things in life that I should be interested in doing, and
like what?
And that I would have to do, even if I did have a basketball career, because, you know, I was planning on having life after basketball.
What were your fallback schemes?
Well, when I went to UMass, one of the reasons why I chose the University of Massachusetts was because they had a very good business school. And, you know, I studied management and marketing while I was there. And even though I left school after my junior year, I went back and I got my degree in a program they have called the University Without Walls. And, you know, now I view myself as a business entrepreneur, involved in the Coca-Cola bottling business, cable TV business, and also wearing a few different hats, such as an analyst for NBC. So I think most of my dreams that I had as a youngster have come true, or have the potential to come true.
My guest is Julius Erving. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Julius Erving. A lot of young players lose their bearings after becoming professional athletes because of the sudden fame and because of the money. Did that ever come close to happening with you?
I think I don't think there was ever a period in which I was lost. I had to make some decisions, and I realized that these decisions would impact, you know, what people thought of me. By the time I was 23, if you remember that era, the 1970s, early 1970s, the platform shoes and the bell bottoms and the big afros and everything were very much in style and in vogue. And although I gave in to, you know, the peer pressure to wear those clothes, I never felt totally comfortable that I needed to be Dr. J on the court and Dr. J off the court. So I made a decision that I would always introduce myself as Julius, and I would allow people to call me by my nickname and relate to me because of, you know, how I was able to do some things that might bring them out of their seats. But if I went somewhere, I wasn't going to be the life of the party. You know, I wasn't going to position myself to be the center of attention. That just wasn't my personality. I think I was a little more serious-minded. As a matter of fact, sometimes accused by friends and family being a little too serious at a young age, that I should loosen up and have more fun. But I was having fun, and I was having fun being serious because, you know, once again, the stereotypical image of the day, particularly for the young black athlete, was that, you know, he can't talk well in interviews, and it was all about the things that he can't do outside of playing his sport. And I took that to heart, and I was offended by it, and, you know, had to try and do something about it.
You were always considered quite a role model. Did you ever feel that you were under pressure to be exemplary?
Well, I think, once again, it boils down to commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no greater pressure than the pressure you put on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I received any pressure from anyone else saying, you know, a manager or an agent or a lawyer or fan or anything, saying, well, you got to be like this or you got to do this. I think by being a spiritual person, you know, having a role model like Christ and, you know, having models here on earth who were high achievers, it became somewhat dictatorial in terms of what my behavior would be.
I think you were about 30 when you accepted Christ. Did that happen after a turning point in your life?
I think I knew Christ all along, and I think accepting an invitation at that time to ask Christ in my life came, yeah, it was after a physical setback, but it was also after, you know, being exposed to what I at that time perceived to be the proper route. I mean, I was baptized long before that. I was baptized when I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of proclaiming myself as a follower of Christ, that came as a result of being involved with the Pro Basketball Fellowship and, you know, attending Bible studies with teammates and lay people who were working within the league to unite the players and get them more focused on their salvation, you know, versus their salaries. And at that particular time, after, you know, being out there for the first half of my career, I was out there for 8 years at that time, at 29, you know, I decided that that's where I would direct my life.
I'm interested in what you think of the ways in which the game has changed since you retired. Let me ask you first about talking trash on the court. What do you think of that?
I don't see a permanent place for it in the game, and I think it's winding down a little bit. It's you know, it's a double-edged sword. Some of the highlights that you see on, you know, Sports Center and other highlight shows, even on the news, are of incidents that are sometimes less than flattering. You know, guys banging chests and talking trash and getting in one another's faces after, you know, certain spectacular or so-called spectacular plays are made, as if it's never been done before. And, you know, I mean, there were times when, you know, guys during my era or even before my era, you know, would play, make a play like that, and, you know, he'd just run down the court and play defense. And, you know, now you see a guy tipping the ball and he raises his fist and he runs, you know, by the cheerleaders and high-fives all of them. And, you know, the other team's taking the ball in. His man's beating him down the court. And by the time he gets down there and gets settled from all the celebration, you know, the coach is upset. And personally, you know, I don't see it being productive. I see Madison Avenue liking some aspects of you know, the highlights and the different things that go along with it, you know, the chest banging, different colored hair. What else do you have out there? I mean, you got a few characters who are crying out because they want to be different. And it's going to boil down to ultimately skill and talent and commitment being the difference, as, you know, can be attested to by the Houston Rockets winning the championship. You know, they weren't the team that was, you know, out there banging chests. They weren't the team that was out there doing eccentric things. They were the team that played the game straight and that's how the story is going to end up most years.
Julius Erving, recorded in 1994. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. Coming up, a review of the new film The Truth About Cats and Dogs. This is Fresh Air. Director Michael Lehman, who made a hit with Heathers and a miss with Hudson Hawk, turns Janine Garofalo and Uma Thurman into an appealing Mutt and Jane duo in the new film The Truth About Cats and Dogs. Garofalo claims that stand-up comedy is her first love, but reviewer Lisa Schwartzbaum says that Garofalo had better be prepared for a lot more movie offers.
I hate movies like Frankie and Johnny at the Clair de Lune that are supposed to be about the love lives of plain or at least ungorgeous women. And the casting guys put Michelle Pfeiffer in the lead, only she's not wearing any makeup. And we're supposed to believe that just because she skipped the lipstick and her hair is scrunched up, she's an average-looking woman and not gorgeous Michelle Pfeiffer. The cool thing about The Truth About Cats and Dogs is not only that it's a romantic comedy about the believable insecurities of ungorgeous women, which includes most of us, but that the casting is so inventive. Janine Garofalo from Reality Bites and HBO's Larry Sanders Show plays Abby, a young veterinarian in Los Angeles with her own radio call-in show, and she's terrific, funny, smart, successful, but neurotically dubious about her attractiveness to men. Uma Thurman from Pulp Fiction plays Noelle, who is certainly confident about her gorgeousness, but who is insecure about her smarts. Ben Chaplin, a cute newcomer British actor who, I'm happy to say, does not stammer like Hugh Grant, plays Brian, a nice guy who calls Abby for advice on the radio and is so charmed by her that he ends up asking her out on a date. Whereupon Abby panics because she's sure when he sees her he'll be disappointed, so she gets Noelle to fill in instead. Yes, it's the classic Cyrano de Bergerac situation with a gender twist. And yes, you've got to swallow a pretty big suspension of disbelief pill for Brian not to know that the Abby he's attracted to with his eye sounds nothing like the Abby he's attracted to with his ear. But what makes Cats and Dogs more charming than any other gal pal movie I've seen in quite a while is the wholly quick-witted, natural, anti-actressy talents of Garofalo. She's so hip and appealing, she even warms up Thurman's usually cool reserve. I happen to know that Garofalo has all too undervalued a sense of her own attractiveness in real life. But what does she know? Because all the men I know find her adorable, and all women love her. That's what insecurity is, I guess, and that's the au courant sensibility this old-fashioned romantic comedy revels in. The boy and the girl destined for each other eventually find each other, but in Cats and Dogs, a fulfilling relationship between two women means as much as a romance with a guy. And when the girls get together, they observe their own shortcomings, but don't whine about them. Here, Abby and Noelle riff on fat as a feminist issue.
Are you going to eat that?
I don't eat.
You don't eat. You ordered it.
I love to order. I love menus, but I got to keep the calories down.
God, how can you live like that?
I know. Do you believe you are what you eat?
I guess.
No. See, that's what scares me. I don't eat anything so I can look good on the outside, but on the inside... there's nothing. Oh, I see. Whereas you, on the other hand, you're very rich.
Thank you.
Abby is rich inside, and she's a hot ticket, too. There's an extended scene midway through the movie that's as unexpectedly arousing as they come. It's when Abby, the real Abby, and Brian have an impromptu phone date that leads to phone sex. One minute you're watching the kind of chaste thing that Rock Hudson and Doris Day might have choreographed, the next minute, you're panting in your seat. And it's here that Cats and Dogs makes its most welcome, if obvious, point. Attractiveness and sex appeal comes from within, not necessarily from color of hair or shape of body. Abby turns us all on because she lets us into her feelings as a woman. She deserves good friendships and sweet boyfriends. Not an unimportant lesson to learn, and one that should make this a new favorite as a date movie or a good choice for girlfriend's night out.
Lisa Schwartzbaum is a film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Our theme music was composed by Jill Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.